I don't know whether everybody heard the question.
No.
No. Okay. So the question was.
Don't follow me.
Ah. Okay. Whether any of the cultural influence of Russian immigrants in Berlin extended beyond World War II. And the second part was. Well, it did, because many of the Russian artists were associated with German modern artists, and some of them were associated with Bauhaus, for example. So their work, while suppressed during the Third Reich, gained much more currency again after World War II. Russian avant-garde, Russian modernism, was under attack in the Soviet Union, particularly under Stalin. So after World War II in East Germany, that would not come back, because the Russian artists that had been shunned and attacked by the Soviet Union, by Stalin, had no presence in East Germany and in East Berlin. In the West, that was a different story. Yes, I mean, as part of the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, the German armed forces were much reduced. They were reduced. They were not allowed to have more than 100,000 troops in total. The general staff was disbanded. They were not allowed to have airplanes and tanks, which, by the way, they made secret arrangements with the Soviet government in the 1920s to train German pilots in Russia. Yes, there was a strong pacifistic and anti-military movement.
There's some, yeah, that's a good question. So the question is on the return to their reserves, were they treated like warriors, or were there special accommodations? In southern Alberta, actually, it's quite well documented in my research that the Niitsitapi people, the Blackfoot people, did, because they had so many secret societies and whatnot, that they had probably institutions within their communities that didn't have to foil against the band chiefs or whoever, and they could accommodate. But like I said, at Paiapot, even allowing one Sundance in 1919 was a really big deal to the Indian agent. They had to lobby for that, and basically somebody wrote a letter: I laid my life on the line, and you're not allowing us to have like one Sundance. So yeah, that's, you know, like probably all over the place. And also, I would imagine that there's a whole bunch of things that happened under the radar, you know, as many things did, right? Yeah.
John, you mentioned Finland Station earlier in your remarks. Now, that term has some symbolic in a sense, I think, of revolution or something. Do you have any idea how it evolved?
All I know is that Lenin made this famous address there, and I think from there it stemmed. But how it sort of was later portrayed in the Soviet Union, I really don't know. Maybe somebody else does.
It gets the name Finland Station because that's where the railway arrived.
Oh, right, from yeah, and Lenin, yeah, he came. Oh, so that's why you were wondering why it was called Finland Station.
Pardon?
You were wondering why it was called Finland Station.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, exactly, yeah. Lots of stations, railway stations at the time, you know, there were many in big cities.
Of course, Lenin arrived there.
He was coming from Finland.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what. Yeah.
There's been a whole lot of new research, even about the 107th. Like I said, there have been a couple articles even in the last few months. So had I volunteered to give this paper earlier, I'd be ahead of the curve rather than a day behind the curve. So that's one of the things, like the actual experiences of the soldiers. One thing I'm interested in as a medical researcher is I was struck by how many people were rejected for tuberculosis. And File Hills will be actually one of those communities that had a very high volunteer rate, but their tuberculosis rates undermine that. In fact, the Tsupina Reserve, the Sarsi Reserve, that every single man registered on registration, whenever that was in 1917, that they were all taken off the roll because they had tuberculosis. I'm not sure if that was manipulation on the part of the Indian agent, but from my perspective, I'm very interested in their health. Another aspect of this is probably being a soldier and doing well, say, as a corporal and getting some training and then coming back and being trained and being able to work off reserve if you were permitted. That was probably as good as a First Nations person, at least in Western Canada, could hope to do. And I've even spoken to some of my population health colleagues about looking at the arc of military veterans, Indigenous military veterans, to see if that little leg up, having a, because it would be a trade rather than a profession, but being a mechanic or a millwright or something like that would actually change the determinants of health ever so slightly, that they would have a longer healthier life. That's what I've been thinking about. Well, what Holt said was, somebody's gonna have to go in, and what he did is he deconstructed the number, the 500 out of 800 that I originally proposed, probably in my abstract. Mm-hmm. And what he said was, that's mathematically impossible, because only 500 soldiers went, and he looked at, like 120, and many of them were European. So that number just doesn't make sense. So what he proposed is, and if there's a grad student out there looking for a project, that's the kind of project it's gonna be, because what you're gonna have to do is, Métis people, despite the race, the history of racism, were citizens. So we would have to look, we as researchers, would have to look into their enrollment records, probably as individuals, to really determine what those numbers are.
Well, that would be online.
Yeah, they are online, but yeah.
When it comes to studying the history of the Métis, how can you respond to the education
I can't. That's part of my point. Yeah.
I'm not
yeah.
even sure you could find them.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Like, if they came from St. Louis, and but that would be a huge undertaking. It's not just a question of counting them up. And like I said, that 3,500 or 4,000 number was Duncan Campbell Scott. That was kind of reified. He wrote a report in 1919 praising the soldiers as he's sending them back to the Indian Act and their loss of freedom. And actually, they First Nations soldiers got the vote in the ones who were in the military. I believe there was a federal election in 1917. They got to vote in 1917, and when they came back, they lost the vote.
I think one more question from me on the side.
Dr. Rado, was the Russian community in Berlin sort of, were they using Nazi propaganda, like supposed Nazi propaganda in Berlin, sort of,
Not really. By that time, the Nazi propaganda was aimed at Bolsheviks and Bolshevik Jews. The Nazis saw a close connection between between the ethnic group and the religious group. But there was really no propaganda aimed at Bolsheviks per se. The propaganda was aimed at communists, German communists, and the international communist community. And so the anti-communist propaganda by the Nazis was largely aimed at German communists, who then were accused also of being in cahoots with the Bolsheviks in Russia.
Thank you very much, and let's go and drink some wine up on the sixth floor.